It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfarth. Today we're talking about prepping for paddling season. I'm not planning on a show for beginners today. I know a lot of our listeners know how to paddle a canoe, kayak, or raft, and you're looking eagerly at the ice, and you're waiting for open water. For the next hour, we're going to share some ideas for trips you could tackle this summer. Think about how to be safe and prepared. Good to think about even for experts, as we can all become complacent. And look at the next set of skills or the next upgrade in equipment that could help you enjoy the summer even more. And it's a very appropriate day to be doing this, because tonight is the Kinnick Canoeists and Kayakers Safety Meeting at Lusac Library at 5:30, which is an opportunity to connect with people who are doing these sports, and also to get signed up for some trips. And it's free, open to the public. And I've got two folks who are going to be presenters there tonight, and also expert paddlers. Jim Gonski has the Alaska Kayaking Academy. He's been our guest here before. Thanks for coming back, Jim.
Honored to be here.
And Zach Fields is a whitewater and sea kayaker, and sounds like he's paddled just about every kind of boat around and also teaches people how to do it. Thanks for coming, Zach.
My pleasure. Great show, Charles.
So what's happening tonight at 5:30?
Well, the Kinnick Canoe and Kayakers Club, Jim and I are both involved with that, are doing a safety meeting, and it's really a chance for folks to get involved with canoeing, rafting, sea kayaking, and pack rafting. There are going to be classes in each of those disciplines. So if you know some about any of those and you want to learn more, or if you're a rank beginner and want to check out one of those, you can come to the Lusac Library tonight, get signed up for the classes.
All right. And Jim, you're going to be presenting there as well, and you also have your own business. Tell us a little bit about that.
We do. Alaska Kayak Academy has been around now for 10 years. And if it has to do with paddling, we do it. So we do canoeing, we do sea kayaking courses, we do pack rafting courses, we do whitewater kayaking courses. The two most predominant courses that we run are sea kayaking rescue courses, and pack rafting are the two really big ones. And you can go to our website at www.kayakcenterak.com. You can see all the different types of programs that we run on instruction. We also have guided programs. We also rent gear. We also sell gear. So we have a whole plethora of things related to paddling.
Excellent. So we're going to divide up the show into fourths today, and we're going to try to go through each of these sports and talk a little bit about the issues surrounding them, great trips you can take, maybe some trips you haven't thought of before, ways you can upgrade your skills and your equipment and learn more about it. And we're going to do it this way. We're going to start with talking about sea kayaking, then we're going to talk about whitewater kayaking or pack rafting. Then we'll talk about canoeing, and we'll finish it up with long-distance rafting trips. Sea kayaking is sort of turned into the Alaskan sport. You know, I remember when people thought, "See, kayaking on the sea, that's crazy." I guess that shows how old I am. But now it's like the, you know, people assume that's how you get out into places like Prince William Sound, Ketchumak Bay, Resurrection Bay. It's super popular, and people think of it as being very, very safe. I always feel like you should have some experience. You should learn how to do it before you go out and do it yourself. But, you know, in terms of a family way to get out, it's sort of like backpacking on the sea, and it's a great way to go. I feel like in terms of talking about great trips you can do, you know, probably in our region, Prince William Sound is the place to go and to get, you know, taken out by a water taxi and stuck somewhere in the middle of Prince William Sound, Night Island Passage, those kinds of areas. I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts on great places to go sea kayaking?
Well, my brother and I did a trip last summer from Whittier to Valdez, and he had never sea kayaked before at all. Wow. And I think that's one of the great things about sea kayaking is there are definitely risks. You don't want to go out there knowing nothing, but it's easier than jumping on a hard whitewater river. And if you're with an experienced person, and especially if you have a dry suit, you know, you do have a margin of safety. And one of the great things about sea kayaking is, you know, hiking, you're looking at your feet, mountain biking, you're looking at the trail in front of you, paddling, you're looking at the next rapid, sea kayaking, you're looking at this amazing rainforest and glaciers around you. And I've certainly seen more wildlife sea kayaking than any other sport in Alaska. And it's also very efficient. It's not that hard in good weather to cover 25 miles a day, and you just see an incredible amount of wilderness.
Yeah. Although, Jim, you with this sport and with all the paddling sports we're going to talk about, fitness counts, right? I mean, if we talk about getting ready for the season, having that upper body and being able to paddle efficiently is important.
Well, you know, I thought about what Zach said there about a 25-mile day. And I would say that most people would be taxed to do a 25-mile day because it's so important to pay attention to the tide.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference paddling from Whittier out to Decision Point if you're with or against that tide. But the other important thing is learning how to paddle with your core. You really need to do torso rotation to have strong abs, because if you have strong abs and use your shoulder and your back by twisting and not pulling the paddle, you can do a 25-mile day. But so many people do what I call arm paddling, where that rotation is happening with the forearm, and they're pooped after a couple hours of paddling and been out of wind. And their hands are getting blistered because they're holding the paddle too tight.
Arms start to feel rubbery.
Yeah. You know, people, they got to remember that paddling is pushing. You push the paddle through. You don't pull the paddle through. And when you do that, you use all the big muscles of the body, and then you can get into a rhythm, and you can go for hours and hours and hours.
Well, as we transition, you know, that's the same story with Nordic skiing as well. You're trying to use those poles with your abs, not with your arms. And I guess that's because you're trying to use some larger muscle groups that are not going to fatigue as easily.
My brother learned that the hard way. He was completely exhausted halfway through the second day going down around Blackstone Point, and had this point where we actually had to tow him to shore, and he just like fell down on the beach. He called it Failure Beach. You know, he went back in the trees, and we were talking about, all right, rotate with your torso. But he learned it, and, you know, we had a great trip. But Jim's absolutely right. You know, get your paddle stroke down. Everyone's strong enough to do it if you have the right kind of paddle stroke.
Do folks spend time in the gym working on their upper body in preparation for paddling? I mean, I guess if you're active all year, maybe that's not necessary, but I'm curious.
No, I disagree. You have to be doing very ab-specific stuff. And if you are, then you'll be fine. But it's like all sports. You can do all the gym workout you want, but then when you actually go do your sport, like cross-country skiing or paddling or downhill skiing, all of a sudden you find muscles that you didn't know were there that never got worked on the exercise ball, never got worked on the weight machine, never got worked on the free weights. There's nothing like doing your sport. One good thing on paddling right now is at Bartlett High School on Wednesday nights, you can get a kayak in there and you can do some paddling and just start getting those muscles going. And we have two pools at Bartlett, so there's a lot of room for paddlers over there. So that's a great way, warm water. It's also a great way to flip your boats and just go back through your rescues again, even though you might have done them before, especially in sea kayaking, because in sea kayaking, you don't flip over very often, right? But when you do, it's a major deal. And people, you know, in whitewater kayaking, we practice rolling all the time. And I consider rolling a required stroke in whitewater. I don't consider it a required stroke in sea kayaking. But doing a deep water rescue is. And if I was taking anybody out for the first time, so if I knew how to paddle, had a lot of years of paddling, and I'm trying to get some friends involved, and I'm going on a multi-day trip, I would definitely get them in the pool or in a lake if the pools close up after after May here, and flip them. Because, I mean, I run classes. I run hundreds of people through classes, and there are people who do not realize they are water phobic until they flip in a kayak, and then all of a sudden they have a panic attack. I've never had anybody get stuck in a kayak, and that's a common perception. I'm going to get stuck in the kayak upside down. And the answer is no.
You'll fall out, but
I mean, there's lots of times when we go through how to get out and the person flips and they panic and they don't pull their spray cover. They just run a knee right through the spray skirt, you know, because survival takes over, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I think it's real important. And I tell parents with children, get into the pool during the wintertime and flip boats. Let them play around on the boat. Let them try to stand on it like a surfboard. Just have fun. And so they get totally used to it. That capsized boat is not an emergency. That way, if it happens out there, you don't have a panic situation.
Yeah, it seems to me that sea kayaking has gotten, some people are pretty casual. You know, they maybe go out a couple of times on a tourist thing where there's no, it's presented as being risk-free and totally easy and it's slow and you never flip, right? And they, oh, I know how to do this, right? And then they might rent one, you know, and maybe they never do the kind of training you're talking about, really having the skills, which is a great thing about the meeting you're doing tonight, is making sure people are up to the level they need to be, right?
Yeah, you think about flipping over a kayak I don't know, 200 yards from shore in the process of getting cold and getting back in it. It's a recipe for hypothermia if you're not prepared, which is why I think if you're going to go out and you don't have a lot of experience, it is a good idea to wear a dry suit as backup, gives you a significant margin of safety if you were to flip over far from land. And a lot of folks who paddle pack rafts already have a dry suit, so don't have to spend the money if you've already got it.
Yeah, I think another critical thing too, Charles, is people need to learn how to look at both the topographical map. I personally am not that concerned about a chart, because charts tell me the bottom of the ocean, and we don't draft a lot of water in a kayak. So I'm more concerned about where can I land, where are there going to be headlands, how far am I going to have to paddle before I'm going to find another beach I can land on.
And this Trails Illustrated maps that are printed on plastic are nice because they actually show some campsites, which most people will not tell you. They don't want you to know about your favorite their favorite campsite, right?
Well, the great thing about Prince William Sound is there are campsites almost everywhere, but there are a few places when my brother and I were paddling where we would sometimes go 2.5 hours at a time without having a landing spot. And that's where Jim's right. You know, you need to read that topographic map and anticipate it, because you don't want to be trying to make that long crossing or a long pull around a point if weather is coming in. You want to make sure you have a real clear weather window, because that's where it could be dangerous.
Let's talk weather and why you should be carrying a VHF radio. Because not only are you going to pick up the weather report, but you can use that radio. Like, say the ferry comes by. You can call the ferry and ask them what were the seas like further out. And if they tell you the seas were building, and you know that that is about 2 hours from you, you know weather's coming in, you can start making preparations to get off the ocean or look at your group and identify your group skill level. You know, what's another major mistake that people make, Charles? And that is they let their kayaking groups get spread out. Everyone's paddling at a different speed. Everybody stops at different times, and it gets more and more spread out. And flat, smooth seas, okay. But, you know, when the weather changes, I mean, I've watched fog come in a matter of 20 minutes. Fog can come in and cover everything up. Winds can all of a sudden pick up. It's important to have someone who's a leader in thinking safety and think, you know what, I need to tighten this up. We need to tighten up and notice who's getting tired.
Yeah, somebody needs to be in charge of your trip. Somebody needs to be responsible for knowing what all gear's in there and that you've taken care of. Hopefully you have a personal locator beacon. At least I feel like that's really important if you're somewhere like the Sound. Certainly a VHF, that, you know, weather band, and be able to, but somebody's going to have the list, know that all that stuff has been packed, and presumably that person's going to be kind of in charge of the trip. And that's part of your preparation for the season. It's like you're sitting talking to your friends, hey, let's do it. Okay, well, who's going to be responsible for what? I mean, you go through that, Zach?
Yes. And I think, minimum for sea kayaking is a weather radio where you can call folks, other ships in the area. You need a watch, because that's necessary to measure the times. You need a tide chart, and you need a compass, because there are areas in the Sound where you'll be far enough from land that you can't see land if there's heavy fog, and you need to be able to lay that compass on your lap, on your spray skirt, and paddle in the right direction until you hit land.
So you don't worry about like a handheld GPS?
I don't think a GPS is necessary. If you know how to use a compass and topographic maps, it's great to have if you have one.
It can be very confusing as to where exactly you are. So, I mean, if you don't want to worry about navigation, a GPS can be nice.
I hate those little teeny screens on GPSs. Yeah. I'm an old map and compass dude myself. You have a nice map chart laid out on your deck. You got your camera, and you would be amazed how easy it is to get turned around.
Oh, I know.
Out in Prince William Sound,
especially in the fog, you come out of the fog. Well, this point looks like that point.
It can be a clear blue sky day, and you all of a sudden make a turn to go into a beach to take a break, and then you come out, and then you're looking and going like, "Well, that isn't that Entry Cove over there?"
Yeah.
No. Now you need to turn.
I want to talk about locator beacons, because I carry one on my boat. It's just a I think it cost me like $600, and it's got a button that if I really was in trouble, I could, a satellite would tell the Coast Guard where I was. Different people have different opinions about the value or necessity of that. I'd like to hear about what you guys think.
My girlfriend and I have one. It's called Spot, and I actually like it because my parents can see where we're taking trips.
Oh, yeah,
and, you know, it drops this little pin down in the middle of an awesome area, and for family and friends. It's really cool to get to see the places we were going. We've never had to use it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a lot cheaper than a sat phone. It's a lot smaller. It's waterproof.
And it's frankly more reliable, too. At least my use of sat phones, I've had a lot of trouble with them. Jim?
Oh, really? You've had trouble with sat phones?
Yeah, it seems like you'll not be able to... I haven't used one in a few years, but it seems like you might not be able to get a good connection or the person can't hear you. I mean, if I was really in trouble and you got to know who you to call for that particular spot that you're in, I'd rather just be able to press a button and have a GPS tell somebody where I am. What do you think, Jim?
Until you have a real emergency, and when you have a real emergency, the ability to get two-way communication going is immeasurable. Mm-hmm. Number one, you get communication back that they know about you and that they're on task is very, very mentally relieving in an emergency situation. And then secondly, you're in a position to communicate more information. So I think a satellite phone, they're inexpensive to rent now. And the locator beacons, you have annual subscription services, and it's easy to get complacent on batteries and yada, yada, yada. You just rent a phone for that one trip you're taking. And it didn't cost very much, and maybe you never did use it, but by God, if disaster strikes, they are really worthwhile to have two-way communication.
All right.
But in that meeting tonight, should have in the meeting tonight, there's a one on Sea Kayak safety. And so the person giving that should go through flares and all the different types of safety equipment you should have with you on a trip.
I also think that competent travelers don't need either the beacon or the sat phone if they know what they're doing and they have the other correct safety equipment, because let's face it, people lived a long time without all this stuff.
Well, I was thinking when we started out, there was no VHF out the sound, there's nothing. You know, you wouldn't hear a voice on it for days, and you knew that you had to take care of yourself. But it's better to have it if it's available.
You know, Zach mentioned about going from Valdez to Whittier, right? Now, my experience is campsites, not just landing resting sites, but campsites are far and in between in Prince William Sound. And you have a low tide. Yeah, you can find beaches to get out on. But when you actually start contemplating setting a tent up here somewhere and you look at where the high tide line is, mm-hmm. you're like, that wouldn't work.
Yeah, I've made that mistake.
I think, you know, you need to be on top of your campsites because they are, and anytime you go out paddling in Prince William Sound, you should go into places, get out, check them out, make marks on your map, know where some emergency campsites are that maybe only one tent can fit in. Mm-hmm. But if push comes to shove, weather, fatigue, whatever.
You can always camp in the muskeg if you absolutely have to and you have a... But
if anyone's listening to the show and actually is concerned about campsites, they can definitely get in touch with me. I was making a lot of notes. We actually found plenty of campsites.
Good.
I think there's a big difference between...
It depends on how much space you need and what
your requirements are. A two-person group versus a 15-person mm-hmm. group. There are almost no campsites for a 15-person group. There are almost countless campsites for a two-person group. But that's where you got to read those topo maps. And I found that...
And it's experience. And that's actually, when I first started, I talked to a friend and said, hey, I'm going out with my kids. You know, he didn't want to tell me because he said, hey, part of this is an adventure and finding your own. And I really valued that. He ended up, out of pity, giving me a couple of emergency spots I could go to. But basically, it's finding your own, exploring, and that's why you're there. I got to tell the audience that it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're getting, Monica's excited that I remember to do that. Jim Gonski is with the Alaska Kayaking Academy. Zach Fields, just a real experienced paddler. Both are going to be there tonight at Kinnick Canoeists and Kayaker Safety Meeting at Lusac Library at 5:30. Let's move on to whitewater. We could obviously do a whole hour on sea kayaking. We have, but getting ready for whitewater kayaking and pack rafting. And let's just start again with favorite trips. Zach, do you want to take that? I mean, what are some of your trips you like to do? And I guess these would... I mean, there's some spots around the region that are super famous. Maybe you have some special ones that you'd like to throw out.
I think a great overnighter for folks who don't want to get on big whitewater right off the bat is 20 Mile. Hike the Winter Creek Trail, starts right behind the Alyeska Resort. Go over Berry Pass, put in on 20 Mile, float back out to Seward Highway. Easy bike shuttle. And, you know, that's a relaxing two-day trip.
Pack rafting trip.
For pack raft. And it's a lot of people do it in one day. That's a long day. And that's a very scenic trip. For whitewater, I really like 6 Mile, Echo Bend of the Eagle River, and Willow Creek. But all those, you got to be really careful about water level.
And know what the heck you're doing.
And know what you're doing. Those are harder whitewater.
6 Mile, the most challenging river around here?
Well, I haven't pack rafted the Third Canyon, which is a big step up from the first two. So the first two are pretty comparable, I think, to Echo Bend or Willow.
We're talking, what about, do you do whitewater rigid kayaking, don't you?
I do whitewater canoeing, not canoeing. Hard shell kayaking.
Okay. Jim, what are some of your favorites, and let's maybe some different ability levels?
Well, you know, in whitewater kayaking, you're primarily doing just day trips unless you can get raft support, right? Mm-hmm. So a very common one to do around here that's really easy to do is Eagle River, a section called Bridge to Bridge and a section called Down to the Base. And that's all great Class 2 water, one Class 3 rapid in there. The other thing, it's really fun in whitewater kayaking is getting into Clearwater River. So 6 Mile Creek up in Turnagain Pass. And Zach just mentioned how there's Canyon 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. And each canyon becomes progressively more difficult and more demanding. And that's an intense run. Willow Creek is a very, very good run. And Willow Creek is nice because the water gets more demanding in terms of Class 2, 3, and 4 as you move upstream. So, you know, so many rivers you can have a great Class 3 run, but then there's some 4 in there, and you might even be in canyon that you can't get out of, and so that stops you from going because you're only an intermediate paddler, whereas Willow Creek has all kinds of great water. But an important thing to do is you need to go to the USGS site or NOAA site, and on our website, kayakcenterak.com, under Friends, we have a link to both of those. And they have real-time river flow data. And the river flow data is like the stock market. If you don't follow it, the number 16,000 means nothing to you.
Right.
Well, the same thing if I tell you that Willow Creek's at 700, that means nothing to you. So it's very important for paddlers, whether the pack rafters or whitewater kayakers, especially in the beginner intermediate zone, to, when they run, you have your smartphone, pull out, look at it, make a note, okay, today the river was running at 800 CFS. And it was challenging,
mm-hmm.
but I felt good.
Write it down in your log.
Yeah, write it down because you do forget. And then, you know, you get ready, you want to go up there next Saturday, and it's been raining, and now it's flowing at 1,200 or 1,300. And if you found 700 pushy, don't get on it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go find a different river, right? But if you found that you were able to do, last time you did it was at 900, and it was definitely, you were on, it felt very, very good, 1,200 is going to be a lot bigger, a lot faster. You know, and that's the key thing. When river flows increase, everything gets faster.
Right.
So before, when you had 5 seconds to make that move, now you have 2.5 seconds to make that move. And depending on your skill level, you may not quite be there. And now missing the move means consequences.
Right, right.
Okay. Do you find
that in terms of people knowing their ability levels and being ready to move up to a higher class of rapids, I mean, people usually know that, or do you work with more advanced paddlers or mostly just with beginners?
Nah, because you see, whitewater kayaking is a macho thing.
Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be taught, right?
So, you know, whitewater kayaking, generally, it is the 25-year-old macho male that, like, how hard can it be anyway? And so, you know, hey, I watched a YouTube video. That looked good. I'm on it, right? So
Zach's laughing over here. Zach, do you want to chime in on that? Agree or disagree?
I would never impugn my fellow paddlers that way. Jeff's right.
It's like skiing the North Face or skiing, you know, going out. And we always, somebody made fun of my show and said, you know, oh, it's the male hardcore extreme show, though that's not true, but we do a little bit of
that. What is worth talking about, like, what's a logical way to step up your skills in this area? And I think, you know, if you get out on Eagle River, it's great. You can do it after work. Check out the meetup group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get out and you're very comfortable with Eagle River. I think it's reasonable to do the first canyon of 6 Mile at lower water levels, like maybe 9.7 feet. But you want to study up, and some really good guidebooks are Andrew Embick's Fast and Cold. And Timmy Johnson has a great guidebook that's focused on South Central streams, and those have some data on the water levels that Jim was talking about. And then you can kind of plan out your progression, because you do want to step up your skill level in a way that is not unsafe.
Right, right. It's very similar to backcountry skiing in that way, is that you really need to be conscious of what you're tackling and know your people you're going with, so you're not getting over your head that way. What, Zach, is there stuff that's done in terms of prepping for the season, either personally or group-wise? I know there's work sometimes done to clear snags and get some of the rivers in shape. Tell us about that.
In terms of gear, Luke Mel, thingstolookat.com is his website, has a really good tutorial on how to put thigh straps into your pack raft. And I think that more than anything gives you a lot of control, even if you don't know how to roll your pack raft. I don't. Having those thigh straps gives you a lot of edge control and can step up the type of water you can get on.
Okay, cool. What about the work that's done in rivers? I mean, I've read about that folks go out and pull stuff out of rivers. Either guys know about that?
Oh, yeah, it definitely happens in the pack rafting form. I'd say the pack rafters are more actively involved in trying to do that than any other kind of user group is out there. And I think the pack rafting forum is a great place to get beta on if there's been a new tree across the river. People are always posting, I was on the river Tuesday, the following thing happened. I know, for example, take Moose Creek up in Palmer area, great. That's a great little run. It's a great run between 250 and 350 cubic feet per second. Big difference in the two flows. But there's a gentleman, Mark Odout, who loves doing that river. And he has been religious about him and John cutting wood out of that thing. You can go into that or get hold of Mark. He's on the forum all the time and find out. But you know, it's like all whitewater, especially after a rainstorm, you just don't assume. What you do assume is something's going to be in the river, and you're always on your toes. You're always paying attention. I was going to mention on pack rafting, I think even for the regular just all-around pack rafter, I think a foot brace by putting a block in the end of the boat and putting a back band like we have in a whitewater kayak is far more valuable than thigh straps. Far more. I've talked about torso rotation, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. If you have a foot brace, you can do good torso rotation in that pack raft. If you have no foot brace in there and you have 2 or 3 inches between your foot and the end of the boat, you know, thigh straps can hold you and they're great for bracing, but for just general paddling, which I'd say 80% of pack rafters are using their pack raft in the historical way of being a tool to get down water barriers.
It's kind of like skiing. You want your ski boots tight. You want your pack raft to be basically stuck on that lower part of your body, and that's how you have the most control.
Yeah, yeah. So you feel like most people are using it. They put it in their pack. They're doing a wilderness expedition. They're popping it in the water to do part of the expedition, pulling it out, rather than somebody who's going out, like Zach was mentioning, to float a particular river.
Well, I mean, we have a very popular course called Packrafting 201, Whitewater Safety Skills. So it's a combination between whitewater paddling and swiftwater rescue. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably run 100 people to that class during the summer, correct? And 80% of those people, they're there because they want to learn how. The goal of this course is to have you running Class 3 whitewater at the end of the class and feel comfortable in it, okay? And 80% of the people who take that class don't go pack rafting to specifically seek out the adrenaline rush. Mm-hmm. They go pack rafting because they're backpackers and they like the idea of being able to hike someplace and then come out a different way on the river, but they're going to run into some whitewater in there and they want to become. I've had many people come safe, and do the class to come back and say, man, if I'd known this when we were on such and such a river, we would have run that instead of walking around it. But we didn't understand how current works. We weren't comfortable yet. Then I would say you have the other 20% are interested in definitely going after Class 3 whitewater and are hiking up some canyon specifically because it's got rapids in it. Mm-hmm. And then you got the 10% that are out there saying, I want to push the limit. I want to turn this pack raft into a whitewater kayak. I want Class 4 water. I want to get scared. I want the whole adrenaline. That's the whole reason why I'm carrying this thing.
And while we're on the subject of...
Just the parallel to backcountry skiing strikes me. Monica's looking at me again. We're supposed to take a break soon, but go ahead, Zach, with your thought.
Well, while we're on the topic of traditional pack raft trips, for people who haven't done it, the Sanctuary River in Denali National Park is awesome. You hike in from the Sable Calico Pass area over this beautiful pass and can paddle down the Sanctuary River. Definitely recommend it for people who want to get out on a pack raft. Mm-hmm. Pretty easy trip, but spectacular scenery.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been a really interesting show so far, and we've still got another half hour. In the second segment of the show, we're going to get into some other paddling sports. We're going to talk about canoeing for those, you know, it's a great, amazing family sport. But we also have had canoeists have, you know, gone across the entire state. So there's a big range of stuff that's being done in canoeing. And then we're going to wrap it up talking about rafting and doing some of those long wilderness expeditions. But first, we're going to be and I want to tell you who my guests are. Jim Gonski, who runs the Alaska Kayaking Academy. There's a link to that at alaskapublic.org if you want to find out more about his business. Zach Fields is an avid whitewater and sea kayaker, pack rafter, and both are going to be presenting tonight at the Canoeists and Kayaker Safety Meeting. Starts at LUSAC Library at 5:30 with tables, and then 6:30 there'll be presentations, and you can learn a lot and sign up for trips if you go to that. It's open to the public. But right now we're going to take a quick break. Have you ever seen those life jacket loaner boards at water access points across Alaska? They come with a pretty frank tagline, "Kids don't float." We checked into the program to learn more about it, and that's what we're going to hear right now. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth.
My name is Kelly Toast. I'm with the State of Alaska Office of Boating Safety. 5 out of 6 boating fatalities are cold water related drownings following a capsized, swamping, or falling overboard. 9 out of 10 are adult males, and 9 out of 10 are in open boats less than 26 feet. 3 out of 4 of the fatalities are involve power boats. Half are in freshwater and half are in saltwater. We have over 700 life jacket loaner boards statewide. There are no barriers to this program, which is why it is so successful. Anyone can clean out their sheds, find their old life jackets, go find a local life jacket loaner board, and put them on the board so that others can borrow them. Anyone can borrow the life jackets. Anyone can wear them. But that's where the educational value comes in, is we talk about in the classroom how to choose a life jacket, make sure that it's U.S. Coast Guard approved, make sure that it's serviceable, make sure that it fits. It absolutely has to fit. With regard to children, it's just really important to know that not only is it the law that they wear a U.S. Coast Guard approved life jacket, but go get some education. Go find out about how to properly fit a life jacket. We're happy to come and talk to any groups, organizations, agencies, etc. We come at no charge, but we're just all about education. People are welcome to visit our website, alaskaboatingsafety.org. The reason why we designed this program is because the kids of today are going to be the adults of tomorrow.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and if you want to learn more about the Kids Don't Float program, we've got a link on our website at alaskapublic.org. Other information there about today's show, including our two guests, Jim Gonski, who's with the Alaska Kayak Academy, and Zach Fields, who is a avid paddler and teaches paddling skills and is part of the Canoeists and Kayakers, who are having their meeting, as we mentioned, tonight at 5:30 at the LUSAC Library. And there's also an event going on that Jim asked me to mention. It's the River Cleanup and Family Float, the 8th Annual Little Sioux Classic. It's Saturday, May 31st. Starts at the Gravel Pit at 11 a.m. ends at the Parks Highway Bridge. It's a 7-mile canoe, kayak, raft race. And where can they find more information about this, Jim?
Yeah, I was surprised that it wasn't on there because it is the Wasilla Rotary that sponsors this, and I think it's in the year number 9, right? And I'm trying to get more paddlers going to this because they get a lot of their Rotary Club members who are not paddlers on this. So what I'd like people to do is just go ahead and email me. So just email info@kayakcenterak.com, and I will get you in touch with Tim, who's going to have all the details. But this is a really, if you've never done Little Sioux from Schrock Road to Houston, it is a beautiful trip. You really feel like you're in the wilderness. There's very few homes along that river. The first mile has got snags. So it's a little bit challenging, but this particular one, they've got it set up. We go along. We now have Matsu Water Rescue is running sweep. So they help out if anybody's capsized the canoe and pinned it on anything. And the water's not big enough that you can't get everything off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might get wet. But we go through a few days beforehand with a motorboat and cut as many snags out as we can, all the ones we think are dangerous. Mm-hmm. The Rotary Club does a fantastic job of every, I don't know, hour or so on the river. There's a fire and there's hot food. There's hot drinks anyway, mm-hmm. and there's a fire to warm up, and you get and keep going. They have a big barbecue in Houston at the end. It's a great family-type trip. You can take pack rafts, sea kayaks, river kayaks, lake kayaks, canoes, all those types of things will float. And there's two parts to it. There's a river race, so those who want to just paddle fast at that, but then there's the cleanup, which is the main focus, and that is you. And they have awards at the end. Whoever brings the most trash in, they weigh your trash, and it's just a good time.
All right.
And it's a full day.
So you can reach Jim through our website, and he can get you more information on that, alaskapublic.org. So we're going to talk about canoeing, and I think that canoeing is a fantastic way for families to get outdoors. You can carry a lot of gear. You can put the younger kids in the middle of the canoe and they don't have to be able to paddle as long as they can sit still. I will precede any canoeing trip by taking the people that I'm going with, usually my kids, out to Little Campbell Lake or some other small water body in Anchorage and practice skills and get everybody comfortable with what we're doing before putting in a river out there. I wonder if, or a lake or whatever, you just want to tune up your skills. And so, what thoughts do you guys have on prepping for canoeing or getting ready for a canoe trip? Do you do much canoeing, Zach?
I'm a canoeing partisan. I love to whitewater canoe and use canoes for wilderness trips. And, if you look at how people have been traveling through the wilderness in North America, canoes are the traditional way to do it. And for a lot of trips, they are still absolutely the best watercraft.
Mm-hmm.
So for folks who, in the era of 5-pound pack rafts, it's kind of easy to forget about this traditional means of transportation, but it's actually an outstanding way to get around. And you can read John McPhee's Coming Into the Country just to see how utilitarian these boats really are, whether you're in South Central or up in the interior. And I'm going to be teaching the canoe class at the KCK meeting you mentioned tonight. So if you want to learn about canoeing, come to the class. We'll learn some white water, and that'll give you the versatility to go out in lakes and moving water.
I feel like a lot of people are comfortable in lakes and slow-moving rivers, but there's another set of skills that you really need to get to before you're ready to move into whitewater in terms of how you control the boat as a team and keep it where you want it in the river.
It's a different set of skills, and it's a very specific set of skills that you can learn.
Yeah, it's called, if you want to get a divorce, get into a whitewater canoe with your spouse. There you go.
That's right.
But it can be... like you said, I was a whitewater kayaker, and then I went into whitewater canoeing, right? And it is a great way to become a team, and it is a lot of fun. You can take Class 3 whitewater and just make it so much fun in an open canoe when you've learned how to paddle tandem, and you can do solo canoeing too, which is an awesome challenge as well. But tandem canoeing in the river, once you understand how to use current, is awesome. But the other thing that people need to remember is when you start taking canoes into the river, you need to add flotation. If they swamp, they're sunk.
You've got approximately 1,700 pounds of water in your canoe, and if it wraps around a tree, you're not getting it off without flotation.
Yeah, so usually one of the major issues with doing a whitewater canoeing course is having all the appropriate equipment, because people can show up with canoes, but without being able to get the proper flotation in there, we're not as safe, right? But, you know, a couple of trips I want to point out, the one treasure that a lot of people in Anchorage don't know about, and that is the canoe trail between Finger Lake to Wasilla Lake up in the valley. That is a great little 7-mile paddle. It's a lake and stream paddle. And there's one portage up and over a hill, not that bad. It is great with little kids in late May, early June, because all of the stream system has water lilies coming out. And the kids like the water lilies, and like we rent boats for that deal. But it's a private, you know, you can easily do everything on your own. But I always love it because, you know, when people rent boats, they come back and the boys, being all good boys, use their paddles like swords, and they cut the flowers off, and the girls come back just with their arms full of flowers, and it's just a homogeneous relationship there. It works out great. The other critical thing, too, is if you go in that system in mid to late July, it's full of red salmon. So if you have visitors up and you want them to see salmon, but you don't want to pay to go out on trips to see those salmon, you can go up there and float. And in the rivers, the stream systems, they school in there and just keep moving around. You just float along in your canoe quietly and look over. Children can hang over the edge of the canoe and we'll look at the fish. They're big red salmon. They're bright red, green heads, easy to see, big schools. It's something a lot of people don't realize, and it's a great thing.
I think a great wilderness trip canoeing is near Glen Allen. You put in on the Little Nalchina River, float down to the Nalchina River and Tazlina Lake, and then float out the Tazlina River to the Richardson Highway. And that's it's about a 4-day trip, very scenic. You have amazing views of the ice field that reaches level across the Chugach. I'd say intermediate to advanced. There's one significant rapid, and the Tazlina River for 40 miles is fast with fairly large waves, but not many obstructions. Mm-hmm. But that trip is really an example of why canoes are such a great wilderness travel craft. You start on a river that's not much wider than the desk that we're sitting around right now, and you end on this large volume river. There's an 8-mile lake in between. You know, it would be miserable to paddle down the lake in a pack raft. Yeah. A raft is too large at the beginning.
Yep.
The perfect craft is a canoe, and, you know, it's their versatility that makes wilderness trips like that possible. And, you know, that's road to road, but it's a wilderness trip. You don't have to pay to fly in, and that's a great trip for experienced canoeists to take a look at.
Where's it put in again?
It's at the bridge where the Glen Highway crosses the Little Nalchina River, and it's in Karen Jetmar's book wilderness canoe trips.
And that's a classic book. The title of it is escaping me at the moment.
And it's just Alaska rivers. So we've talked about guidebooks if you have Karen Jetmars, Timmy Johnson's, and Andrew Embix, I think you've got most of them.
So tell me about upgrading your canoe. You know, I've still paddling around in an aluminum canoe, and it's pretty heavy and, you know, just not advanced. It does have flotation. And, you know, we are in slow water and lakes and stuff, and seems adequate.
There's
nothing
wrong with a good Grumman canoe. I think the best canoe ever made is an Old Town Tripper. The number one upgrade you can do with a canoe is install some knee pads and some thigh straps, and again, it gives you the ability to edge and be locked into your boat. And, you know, if you put knee pads and thigh straps into a Grumman or into an Old Town Tripper and you're a skilled paddler, you can paddle class 3 whitewater on it.
So, Jim, I think a lot of people know how to canoe because they did it in summer camp when they were, you know, 12 years old, and they enjoy doing it, but probably they're not that good at paddling. And it seems to me like canoe paddling, not to denigrate kayak paddling, but there is quite a bit of skill in doing the different strokes and being coordinated. You agree? I mean, a lot to learn there to be really good at it?
Well, you know, all paddling is finesse and technique. And learning the techniques can make it just enjoyable and not work. So I totally agree with you. Canoe paddling, because you only have one blade, and your objective is to pretty much try to stay on your strong side. You don't want to go paddle 4 on the right and then 4 on the left and then 4 on the right. Mm-hmm. You want to get so that you can do a C stroke. The stern knows how to do a good J stroke. You guys know how to do sweep strokes with bow and stern to make the boat spin quickly. You both can do a draw stroke to bring the boat into a dock. There's a combination there that practicing works well, and especially when we get into river canoeing, those are all critical. You need to know how to do a cross bow draw if you're the bow paddler when you're coming into the eddy on the weak side. You need to know how to do a low brace when you're the stern paddler and we're bringing that boat in. So, yeah, definitely more skills required because you have one blade to work on. But yeah, I wanted to go, I want to go back to sea kayak because we mentioned this, we were going to talk to intermediate and advanced paddlers, right? Because I just ran into this last night at the swimming pool. Older paddlers, it is worthwhile to think about upgrading your paddle. Paddles have come a long way, and if you have a 10-year-old or more paddle, I really encourage you to think about trying out newer paddles. You will love them, and they will make your paddling so much more effortless. And if you're an older paddler, that means your joints don't work as well anymore, and they will love you. It's definitely worthwhile.
What's happening in paddles? Just lighter?
No, not wider.
Lighter, I said.
Oh, definitely lighter. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, take pack rafting. I get people coming for pack rafting classes, they're already geared up, right? And they always have the wrong paddle, right, for whitewater anyway. And so one of the things is weight. One of the things is surface area of the paddle for what you're going to do it on. But another really critical thing, Charles, is length of your shaft. People don't realize how important a shorter paddle shaft is to power. And they go with long blades. They have long shafts. So, and then, I mean, I've seen people with older paddles that are very square-shaped. Mm-hmm. They don't cut through the water. They don't feather through the water very well. And an elliptical-shaped paddle that is longer on one side than the other, they move through the water much smoother, especially when you're doing a sculling draw stroke. Just better.
All right.
Flat out better.
I want to get back to what you were asking about canoes just for 1 second. You know, you were asking canoeing skills. There's so many outdoor activities where, you know, watching someone who does it well is really a beautiful thing. I think probably the pinnacle of all of that is watching people who can paddle whitewater perfectly. It's an amazing thing to see. And one of the things about canoeing is they are less forgiving and you have to learn to read the water. And, you know, I grew up in the Southeast where whitewater canoeing is still prevalent. And there's a whole generation of people who learn to paddle some of the hardest whitewater, what was for generations some of the hardest whitewater around in canoes. And if you watch, you know, a 65-year-old guy paddling class 5 whitewater, knowing down to the half inch exactly what the water is going to do, that's a really beautiful sight. But you can also see that in sort of the longer wilderness trips in the north. You know, and it dates to the Canadian voyagers who were crossing continents, shipping hides. A guy named Bill Mason, you can go YouTube videos of Bill Mason and see how beautiful it really is to paddle a canoe well in the wilderness. So that's
good idea.
I mean, part of the appeal of canoes is practicality, but I think part of it is the tradition.
Aesthetics and the tradition in a fast boat, you know, teamwork. All that's great.
One thing, Charles,
I've got to tell people again, it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. That was Zach Fields. Jim Gonski is, and we still want to get into rafting. So
But you know, going back to what Zach said about paddling in the Southeast where you have a lot of paddlers, right? If you go to YouTube and start watching pack rafting videos, I can watch a pack rafting video and I can immediately tell you that guy has a whitewater kayaking background. That guy didn't. You can see the difference in the style, fluidness, understanding how to run the river. You know, probably one of the most critical things that pack rafters are getting into, too, is muscling, and not letting them get what I call paddle foo. Paddle foo is relaxing and getting a feel for how the boat's moving through. I don't care whether we're on the ocean or whether we're in whitewater, feeling how the boat's moving. And remember that when you're in whitewater and river, you steer. You steer. Don't power through everything. You want to move about the same speed as the river's moving. One, it'll minimize how much water gets inside the boat. Secondly, how much water smashes into you. But you'll have more control of your boat. And then you can start back to finesse and technique. You want to be Jim's rule of slackerism. All paddling, you want to be a slacker. The least amount of effort to get the most benefit.
If you watch an expert paddler, they seem sometimes to almost not be paddling at all, and it's because they're reading the water. And actually, I would say if someone wants to be a really good pack rafter, they should get out of a pack raft and get in a hard shell kayak or in a canoe.
No question.
And learn to read water, and they'll be a much better pack rafter when they get back in, because pack rafts being flexible and being wide and stable are sort of a crutch. And if you throw away that crutch for a little bit and then come back to the pack raft, you're going to be better at it.
Well, I want to move on to rafting expeditions, and this is kind of something that I think people dream about, like what's the trip you'd like to do, because it's the only way you get to cross huge parts of Alaska with a group, stop on the side of the river, camp out, be in a place that's unbelievably remote, slap lots and lots of mosquitoes, and I know a lot of people have sort of armchair dreams about doing this. It's, you know, for the most part, it's pretty expensive. It takes a long time to set up a trip and pretty long time to do a trip, so it's not something you're going to do all the time. But let's talk about that for a few minutes. Zach, tell us about some trips that you maybe are highlight trips of your life and maybe some ones that you wish you could do.
Sure. Well, I guess the first time I set foot in Alaska was on a raft floating down the Tashinsheni River into the Alsek, and that's a pretty special way to get to know a place. And actually, when I moved here on a canoe, so it was really nice to move here that way.
You moved here on a canoe?
Well, when I arrived in Alaska, it was on a canoe and on the Porcupine River.
Oh,
but
wow.
When I first saw the state, it was on the Tashinsheni, and you know, you have to get a permit for the Tashinsheni. You're not going to go this summer.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a permit the first time I applied, and it's a really special river in southeast Alaska. It also passes through some ice fields that are melting faster than almost any other on Earth. So, you know, when I saw the Tashinsheni, it was very evident how fast that ice was melting. So I'd say if you want to see Alaska, see it now, because it's disappearing in a lot of places. And the Tashinsheni is a very special place to see it. But one of the things about rafting is
a lot of guided trips. You know, a lot of tourists are doing, people who are sort of serious tourists are doing that and paying $5,000-$10,000 for the privilege. How did you set up your trip?
I'd like to disabuse people of the notion that rafting has to be expensive. At the time I lived in Virginia, so we rented rafts, but we did that whole trip for under $1,000 per person, and I think we were out there for 12 days, and that included a bush flight out, renting the gear, buying all the food, and hiring someone to do a shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
Very cheap. You would spend more than that, you know,
going out
to dinner and eating lunch and renting a car.
Yeah.
So actually, wilderness trips, I think, can be the cheapest if you just have some skills. And there's a real good guy in Haines named Stan Bohr who rents the whole setup and does the shuttle, and it can be very affordable. But for folks who are looking for the most affordable wilderness raft trip in Alaska that has glaciers and rainforests and wildlife and seclusion, I would definitely recommend doing the Copper, which has all the scenic qualities of the Tashinsheni. The landscape is almost bigger, which is hard to imagine because you're comparing, you know, the biggest, most overwhelming place you've ever seen with the other largest, most overwhelming place you've ever seen.
It's an unbelievable natural place. I mean, incredible.
And the Copper, you can drive to the put-in in either Chitna or I'd recommend up in McCarthy and put it on the Kennecott River, and you can float down and take out at Flag Point near Cordova. You pass through this remarkable wilderness, and you don't have to hire a plane. And yeah, you can do the trip for really the cost of gas and food, maybe a raft rental.
Jim, do you train people up in doing this kind of trip, or is that outside of your? It sounds like you train people for almost anything, so I felt safe asking you that question.
We currently do not do we do overnight sea kayaking, and we do have a week long pack rafting adventure, and we have a teen camp that goes out for an entire week, but that does stay road based as opposed to being remote, carrying carrying the boats at this particular time. But the thing I want to mention about when you're putting together a North Slope trip, and with today's types of boats, think about what it is you're really going to do. How much? I mean, I hear people taking pack rafts, and you know, pack raft, you have to be like a backpacker. So you're out there for 10 days and you've got all the bare minimums with you, correct? Now, you bring a frame-type canoe, like an ollie canoe. That just opened up a couple of big river bags and added a few more luxuries that you can take to make camping out there a little bit nicer. Now let's add an inflatable kayak, and you can now take three river bags in that boat, especially if you use a double kayak. And since almost all the North Slope rivers are class 1 and 2,
yeah,
they don't have technical, difficult, dangerous rapids in them. Another good trip that we're talking about road trips here would be go up to the Tangle Lakes area, go across the Tangle Lakes, and then go down to the Delta River, right? That's a good one.
It's another ideal canoe trip.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Beautiful area.
You know, a really crowded one is Galcana. Okay, but that's another really popular family, Boy Scout, Girl Scout, church group type trip to go do, and that's all road based.
What about just renting like a big, like big river raft, take everything you want along and do, like, go village to village on the Noah Tower.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, is that think about how long you're going to be out.
Total comfort, right?
Yeah, how long you're going to be out and what amenities you want to have. And say, you know what, you know, and if you're going to do those flying trips, the big cost is the plane. Mm-hmm. So you really want to max out days. So you really want these things to be two-week minimum type trips, because that's the big cost is the airplane. And, yeah, now you're starting to get into rafting, correct? And what's the disadvantage of the rafting? Wind. Wind's always an issue on all those North Slope rivers up there, correct? But you got a lot of comfort, too. And especially, you know, but is it more expensive? Sure, because now you may have to take two planes in because you got all the rafting gear and the rowing frame and all that junk. And, of course, when you start taking rafts, you start thinking coolers, you just start thinking big. And you kind of get away from the big thought, but you can still have great trips.
Well, how much do people spend on a two-week vacation, right? I mean, you're not paying for hotels and restaurants and all these other things.
That's my whole point is if you do it right, if you do it yourself, you're actually going to pay less than you would for almost any other vacation. And, yeah, we're talking about do-it-yourself raft trips. Mm-hmm. You know, it might sound kind of crazy to someone who's never rode a raft, but, you know, you can rent a raft at Alaska Raft and Kayak, and you can learn on a river like the Kenai or do a three-day trip on the Chulitna and sort of get comfortable for some of these remote wilderness rivers that don't have large rapids.
Right, you're just going to focus on rivers without rapids, and it's about crossing a lot of beautiful country and having time with your friends. You know, every night you're going to be camping
and
out.
Having a camp chair. You cannot beat a camp chair when you're on a multi-week trip, man.
I want to throw out there, Charles, last summer, my girlfriend, some friends of ours, and I did the Talkeetna River. Flew in from Talkeetna, and for people who are looking to do wilderness, whitewater, with awesome scenery, it'd be really hard to beat that trip. Very cheap. It's a 30-minute flight. Mm-hmm. You can spend 4 days. You could spend a lifetime in the Talkeetna Mountains.
How do you organize that trip? Where do you fly out of?
We use Talkeetna Air Taxi. They fly you into a strip near Yellow Jacket Creek. You float back. You get out right in town where the railroad crosses the river, and you can walk back to your car. Mm-hmm. It's the simplest trip logistically. Fantastic scenery, and there's a 14-mile-long Class 3 canyon with a couple of Class 4 rapids that's so much fun, and a raft. It's a great raft kayak trip if some folks want to kayak it and you want to run raft support and throw your stuff in the raft.
Yeah, sounds great.
Well, I know it's like one of my gold coins, you know, you don't want to bring out, but I'll tell you.
All right. We're almost out of time, so
the Chickalung River is one of my favorite rivers, and it can be whitewater kayak. It could be, I mean, my water taxi service can get a canoe in there, definitely a rafting in there.
Excellent.
It is an excellent three-day trip, fly in, wheels.
And we're out of time. We got the gold coin out of Jim. That was Jim Gonski. His business is Alaska Kayaking Academy. It's on our website, alaskapublic.org. Zach Fields was with us. Thanks to both of us. And on the next week's show, we're talking about planning summer trips with kids. It'll be a fun show, and I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.